Okay, that's good. Alrighty, so now it's time for the Dhamma talk. And for tonight's Dhamma talk, what should I talk about? What do you think? Sorry? Veganism? The law of karma, veganism, okay. There's some suggestions. Anything else? Death. You guys. Yeah, sure. Okay, go on. Yeah. Dealing with difficult people. Can you give me an example? No, I don't. I'm only kidding. Okay, sure. Any other suggestions? Any other thoughts? Anatta. Anatta? Okay. Who was that? Trick question. Only kidding. Okay. Yes. All right. Sorry? World peace. World peace. Okay, that's a good one. Okay, so we've got a bunch of different topics. Any other ones? They are all interrelated. Yeah, this is true. Yeah, this is true. For those who missed out on loving kindness, so sorry. Okay. Nobody is interested in like a history of indie rock bands in Perth in the 1980s. Okay, fair enough. No, I understand. We have one vote for that. Okay, I'll see if I can get a little bit into that. Well, actually, I'm going to start by ignoring all of your suggestions, and I will talk about the history of indie rock bands in Perth in the 1980s. Reason being was because a couple of weeks ago, I happened to meet a completely outside of any kind of reasonable context, but I met this lady who was from Perth, and it turned out we had a lot in common, and she had brought up in a very kind of conventional Perth upbringing. And in the early 1980s, she went to see a rock band called The Scientists. So any of you from that era probably remember The Scientists. They were kind of one of the seminal post-punk / grunge bands from the time. And that just blew her away. She's like, wow. You know, she went from a conservative Catholic schoolgirl to shaving her hair and getting mohawk and putting piercings through her body and all of these kinds of things. And, spent a few years kind of doing that. But after that, she's what that did was that showed her something that, like, that there is another way. It showed her that there was something else. And in that way, you can see that's like a step in her life. She ended up doing many interesting things with her life, but she ended up, a lot of her life was spent working on projects empowering women in developing countries, ending hunger by empowering women through going to villages and trying to work with the women there to end hunger in their communities. And so she ended up taking this very, very interesting and very beautiful path in her life from that kind of moment. And so I don't want to say to you, go down to the pub and listen to the local band, because that will send you on your true spiritual path. But it is true that we follow all kinds of different ways to get where we're going. And my own path has been I don't know, it's funny when you think about your life, I think about my life, it just seems like it just happened. I don't know, it's just kind of there. And it doesn't actually seem all like anything. It's just like, you just wake up in the morning and there you are, and you go out in the day and you do those things. But then when you look back at it, then there's all these kind of interesting things that have happened in your life. And one of the interesting things that happened in my life that I remember as a kind of, when I look back at it, I remember it as a kind of a formative moment. It was about in 1985, maybe. And one of the things that I did, apart from being a musician, I was also involved in animal liberation. And so here I'm ticking down the list of topics, right? So here I've got to the veganism bit, and more or less. And so I became a vegetarian and then a vegan at that time. And that was before vegans got really annoying, okay? I can promise you those days we were really nice. Well, some people might disagree with that, but anyway, moving along. I shouldn't say vegans are annoying. Vegans are very nice people. So, right. So I was involved in doing helping to organise a conference called the Getting Together Conference, and it was a group of different people from different kind of progressive groups, environmental groups, and things like that, health groups, and so on. And I think it was in, if I remember correctly, in Leederville High School that we did it. And as part of that conference, I did a panel on vegetarianism. And I was only like 18 or 19 at the time. I was studying philosophy at uni, and I thought I knew all the answers to everything. And so I thought, okay, I'll do this panel. And I was looking for some other people to do the panel with. And somebody mentioned to me that Ken Colburn was a vegetarian. And many of you from Perth would, of course, know that Ken Colburn is very well-respected and very well-known Aboriginal elder from the Noongar people. And for many years in Australia, he was one of the leaders of the Indigenous communities. And so I was told that he was a vegetarian. And so I thought, okay, that's nice. I'll see if he can come and do the panel with me. So I went out to visit him at his home and saw his community and stuff. And he told me that he was vegetarian. He said he's not vegetarian because of any sort of, you know, Western religion or idea or anything like that. He said he was vegetarian because that was following his traditional beliefs. And he said that in his people, that they would never harm any other creature. They saw all of the other animals, all of the plants, everything on the earth as being part of them, and they're like their brothers and sisters, and they would never harm any creature. And he said, but in those days, he said, we didn't have anything else to eat, and so they'd have to sort of apologize and beg forgiveness if they needed to eat kangaroo or they needed to eat snake, and they would kill it, but they would only kill it, and they'd say to it, look, we're really sorry, but I have to feed my family. Sorry, brother kangaroo, right? I'm sorry, sister snake. I have to feed my family. And so that's what they would do. And he said these days, he said the young Aborigines, they think you have to eat snake or kangaroo or something to be a real Aborigine. He said that that's not true. He said that they don't understand how it was. He said these days I just go down to the shop and buy some tofu. That's all right. I don't need to kill kangaroos anymore. And so we did this panel together. And it was very nice, and it was a very formative learning experience for me, because you know I came to that topic from a very philosophical point of view, and I'd read Peter Singer, and I'd read the different philosophical arguments and things like that. And so you know I have this kind of intellectual and philosophical side to me. And but when Ken did the panel, we're starting the panel, and I had all these kind of notes and these things I was going to talk about and so on, and Ken started singing the song, I Just Called to Say I Love You. You remember Stevie Wonder, right? Now, okay, you have to remember, of course, like, you know, I was an indie musician, right? So I hated that kind of stuff, right? Sorry, Stevie Wonder's great, right? I love him, but schmaltzy kind of love songs like that, I mean, come on, right? But when Ken started singing it, there was something really profound in what he was doing, yeah. And I didn't like really understand it at the time. Maybe I still don't, but I could sense that there was something going on. You know, what he was doing was he was establishing a connection. Yeah. He wasn't just telling people what's right and what's wrong. He wasn't just saying this is what we should do, this is what we shouldn't do, this is what the facts are, and so on. He was making a connection that's based on love. And so once he did that, it just changed, it shifted the whole kind of energy in that space. and it made possible a feeling that I can still remember to this day, you know. And if we'd had a conversation about vegetarianism and veganism and these kinds of things, it would have been one of a thousand conversations like that, and I wouldn't remember it. But I remember that moment. So this is one of the things which has really sort of changed my life, you know, looking back on it. And so something about me, I don't know why it is, but something about me, I've always tried to live in a way, and I've always been somehow kind of aware of or connected to or looking for a connection to something bigger than myself. And I don't know why. It's so weird. I look back and I think, it just seems like that's just like who, it's just like what I do. It's just like, that's just how my mind works. And it took me a long time to realize that not everybody's life and mind works that way. Yeah. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just who I am. And so I always kind of tried to live in accordance with these kinds of things. When we just did that meditation now, we did that meditation on death. And one of the things about, you know, when we did the meditation, we talked about how death is the other side of life and how this is a cycle. And again, we all know that. It's this very simple idea, right? So intellectually, in terms of an ideology or a concept, yeah, of course we know that. But how do we actually contact that? How do you actually make a connection with that? You know, and this is what Ken was doing in his presentation. He wasn't about telling us what the ideas were. He was about how do we make that connection? How do we make that connection with ourselves? How do we, in the future, like that the outcome of the choices we're making now, that's where it will end. And that's an act of compassion and an act of love to think about yourself in that way. And to recognize that that's not just me, but that's everyone. All human beings, all animals, all sentient beings, sabbe satta. The Buddha said it so many times, again and again and again, sabbe satta. All beings, even like aliens and stuff. And one of the last talks I gave here a couple of years ago was on Buddhism and aliens. That was a classic. So I want you to try to think about it in this way, like when we did that meditation before, right? That just to think in terms of that love for who we are to become, that how are we going to come to that moment with a sense of peace? One of the great benefits of being a monk is that we get to hang around a lot of dead people. We get to go to funerals and these kinds of things. And funerals are really good. I always enjoy a good funeral. Mainly because people sit down and shut up and you can talk to them. And they listen. And you have some very interesting experiences you have there because you see different people's responses to it. One funeral I always remember I went to in Melbourne many years ago. And this is a very, very tragic funeral. There was a young couple, youngish couple in their 30s, I guess. They had some small children. And I didn't know that couple very well. I knew their parents well. But they invited me to do the funeral service. And the young mother, who was a doctor, they were both doctors, the mother died in childbirth. Or died immediately after childbirth. And she, when she gave birth, she'd already had two two children without any complications. This was the third child. And then after she gave birth, the very rare immune reaction set in, and her body organs just packed up, and she just died extremely quickly before the doctor could do anything. I mean, how tragic is that, right? And when I did the funeral, her husband gave some words, but he didn't speak. He was too emotional to speak, but he wrote out something. And one of the things that he said there was something I always remember to this day. He said that if he was granted another 5 minutes to spend with his wife, who he loved so much, imagine that. Imagine that you had that 5 minutes. He said, I wouldn't have had anything to say to her. There's nothing left unsaid. They lived every day with the love that they had for each other and the care that they had for each other, and they lived their life fully every day. Now, if we have spent another 5 minutes with her, that's good, but I don't need to say anything. It's already been said. And what a beautiful, what a powerful thing to be able to say. So this is what our life is about. We're here on this planet. My goodness, this poor old planet. Right? I mean, it's just like a thin coating of slime on a rock. That's it, isn't it? We just got this rock floating through space, and space is like really, really big. It's like really, really, really big. Did you see the other day they've just for the first time detected a neutrino? Right? So this is this kind of from so many billions of light years away, and the scale of the universe, it's so big. We haven't even discovered life anywhere in the universe yet. Right? I mean, probably there is life statistically, but we haven't found it. It's really rare. And even right here in our solar system's inconceivably huge. And our planet is just this rock. And on the surface of the rock is just like a few meters. Right? That's all it is. From the ground, a bit under the ground, there's life. Until a few meters up in the air. And then above that, maybe some birds and things like that. And that's about it. And this tiny, tiny, thin slice of life in the middle of this incredible wasteland of just nothing. It's so fragile. And yet, what are we doing with it? We're trashing our planet, throwing plastic everywhere, species going extinct at an incredible rate, forests getting chopped down at an unbelievable rate. In Australia, it's one of the worst countries in the world still for deforestation. The fish going, bees colonies collapsing, the ice collapsing, floods. Just recently I read that there was, 50 people or something died in Canada from the heat? Over 50 degrees in cities in Africa. And our planet is so fragile, and there's so little of it. What are we going to do with our lives? Right? This is all we've got, guys. That's it. Yeah. You can be, maybe if you're Elon Musk or something like that, you can think, well, you're going to establish a colony on Mars. But like living on Mars is really hard. If you think life here is hard, you've got to pay your taxes, you've got to do this, you've got to do that, that's hard. Mars is like really, really super duper hard. Yeah. Realistically, this is all we've got. Yeah? You look around you, the people that you love, the family you have, the community that you have. Yeah? We live in houses, right? We think that we're safe in our houses, right? It's ridiculous, yeah? A house is just a thin, thin little wall that keeps us there. That's all we have. So our life is so very, very fragile. And any moment it can be taken away. How are we living? How are we living every day? How are we living every moment? Do you live your life in such a way that you could say every night before you go to bed, if I died right now, I'm okay with that? Right? Now imagine that you were to do that, right? To make that your practice. You say, okay, I'm going to contemplate death every day, and I'm going to make sure that I live my life so that I don't harm any living creature, so that I love all of those who I come into contact with, that I will live with peace, and I will live with generosity, and I will bring joy to people's lives, such that at the end of every day, I can be happy that I've lived my life well. And you can reflect to yourself, if I die today, then I'm going to be satisfied. Yeah? What do you think the Buddha would say to that, if he heard that that was how you were practicing? I tell you what the Buddha would say. The Buddha would say, you slacker. That's not nearly enough, right? It's not nearly enough to live every day as if it was your last. The Buddha said, live every breath as if it was your last. Yeah, he had pretty high standards, right? Every breath as if it was your last. When you breathe in, you reflect, you say to yourself, I don't know whether I'm going to breathe out. I'd better make this a good one. Yeah, I'd better do what's right and what's good now, because it might, by the time I breathe out, it might be too late. And then when you breathe out, you say to yourself, am I going to breathe in again? Who knows? Right? I mean, that's how it happens, right? I mean, every time that death happens, that's how it happens, right? Somebody breathes out and then they don't breathe in again. And every time that you breathe out, are you going to breathe in again? Who knows? Make it count. Make every breath count. That's how the Buddha asks us to live. So when we do this practice of mindfulness of death, then it reminds us of that fragility of life. It reminds us of the preciousness of this existence. Now, of course, from a Buddhist point of view, right? From a Buddhist point of view, you can say, well, we have many lives. Fair enough. So if we're not, you know, there's always another chance, right? And this is one of the things that that can sometimes, I think, that can sometimes be, how do I put this? Can sometimes, in Buddhism, we can sometimes use this as a bit of an excuse, right? So we can say, well, you know, I can't do all these things. Yeah, it's a nice idea. You know, being mindful and live every day to the fullest and all those. But, you know, that's not where I'm at yet. You know, I'm just struggling to get by. So, you know, maybe in a future lifetime I can do that. Right? A number of years ago, I was invited to do a meditation on loving kindness at a uniting church in Sydney, Reverend Bill Cruz. And so they kind of came along and they did the service. And I was quite surprised because I hadn't been to a Christian service for a number of years. You know, I was brought up as a Catholic. But at this service, and they're like the service starts at 8 o'clock, and they started at 8 o'clock. And they're like, at 5 past 8, we're going to do this. And then at 10 past 8, we're going to sing a hymn. And at 1/4 past 8, we're going to be doing this. And they actually did those things at those times. And I was sitting there thinking, wow, this is amazing. I've been in Buddhism for so long, we've never done anything on time. Well, why is that? And then I realized, it must be because, like, in Christianity, you only get one shot. Right? If you stuff it up this time, you're finished. Right? Whereas in Buddhism, okay, never mind, maybe next time, okay. So we tend to, like Buddhists, it does, I mean, I'm partially kidding, but I'm also partially not kidding, right? That in Buddhism, like, you know, you do see that in Buddhist cultures, that people do tend to be, to have that sense of being relaxed, not so much in a hurry, not so much pushing things and so on. And there's something healthy about that, but also it can fall onto the side of laziness, right? Of saying, oh, you always put it off. And so this meditation, the meditation on death, is the counterbalance to that, right? So if you're feeling complacent, yeah, then this will give you a sense of urgency. Because who knows where we're going to be in the next lifetime? Somebody just asked me that, like, if climate change comes and everyone dies, where do you get reborn? Yeah, who knows, right? Maybe you'll be reborn as a jellyfish? That'll teach us a lesson, right? Not much to do as life as a jellyfish. You know, just one of billions of jellyfish flapping around the dead oceans. Who knows? Right? So the Buddha said, if you try to work out all the details of karma and these kinds of things, you never know. But one of the things that the teachings of karma does, and karma and rebirth does, is that it establishes that similar idea to what Ken Kolbung was talking about. That idea that we're all brothers and sisters, all of these creatures are. And the Buddha said exactly the same thing. It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah? So from the traditional indigenous philosophy and beliefs, they had that idea that we're connected with all sentient beings and they're our brothers and sisters. The Buddha said, through karma and rebirth, exactly the same thing. All beings are our brothers and sisters. We are all connected. Yeah? You think about that next time that you squash a cockroach. Sorry, sis. Right? We're all connected. So we have this kind of idea of separation. But the idea of separation, the idea that we're individuals, is only like a contingent thing, right? Yeah, of course it's real, right? The fact that I'm here, I'm this person, that's who I am. But it's not an absolute. We're still connected. I mean, we've been sitting here in this room now for a while. And as we're sitting here, we're all breathing. We breathe in oxygen, we breathe out CO2. Right? So we are all contributing to climate change as we're sitting here. We're raising the CO2 levels just by existing. That's pretty bad, isn't it? And you can't even stop it if you kill yourself, it's worse because your corpse will decay and it'll make even more CO2. Right? Breath meditation is good for that. Do breath meditation. Breathing slows down. You're contributing less to global warming. Excellent. Right? But that's true, isn't it? We're breathing in that, you're breathing out. That means that something of you is inside me. Some atoms, some molecules that were inside you this evening are now inside me. I've breathed them in. And something inside me is inside you. And we have actually shared our matter as we're sitting here. That's weird, isn't it? Yeah? But that's the reality. That's the biological reality. Organisms don't exist independently. We can only exist as part of that network, as part of that system. And so this is the basis in Buddhism of that idea of loving kindness, that idea of morality, that idea that we should treat all creatures like our brothers and sisters. There's one of the things that I find in Buddhism that's kind of interesting is that people often come to me and say, "Oh, please teach our children about the Dhamma. Please teach our children about Buddhism." And sometimes it seems that what they sort of mean is to tell our children to do what we tell them to do. Which is fair enough. But the Buddha taught children. And one of the beautiful suttas where the Buddha teaches children is where he's walking along the road, going in for alms round, and he comes along a bunch of kids. They're playing with on a pool, and they pulled out a crab from the pool. And, you know, the young boys being boys, and they were playing with, they were being cruel, and they're pulling the legs off this crab. And the Buddha just kind of stopped. What did the Buddha do? Did the Buddha say, bad boys, stop doing that? Did the Buddha say, you're making bad karma, you're going to go to hell? Did the Buddha say, where are your parents? No, he didn't say that. He said, kids, what are you doing? He said, we're playing with this crab. They said, what are you doing? You're pulling the legs off the crab. Ah, really? What do you think, like, what would it be like if someone pulled your legs off? He said, oh, that'd be pretty painful. Do you think it's just you who gets hurt when your leg's pulled off? Or do you think the crab gets hurt when it has its leg pulled off? Well, probably hurts the crab as well. Right? So would you like it if someone did that to you? No, I wouldn't. Well, do you think it's good if you do that for the crab? No, I don't think we should. Yeah. That's how the Buddha taught Dhamma to children. Yeah. And there's a very profound truth in that. In philosophy, they call that the Socratic method. It's the same method that the philosopher Socrates used to use. And Socrates used to use that method for one specific reason, and a very specific reason which is often ignored when Western philosophy is taught. Socrates used that method. He used it with children, but also with adults, everyone that he found, of asking and inquiring and drawing out the implications of a person's own understanding. Why did Socrates use that method? Specifically, he used it because he believed that all beings had been reborn countless times and that they had that knowledge and that wisdom inside themselves. And so he used this method to draw out the wisdom which is found in each person. And that is the meaning, the literal meaning, of the English word education. Think about it, right? What does education mean, right? To educe. Deuce is like a duct, to draw something out. To educate is to draw out, right? We think education is to put stuff into people, right? Education is to draw out. That's the real meaning of it. The point I'm trying to make here is that you already know this stuff. You already know that we need to love each other. You already know that we need to take care of this planet that we're on. You already know that our life is fragile. You already know that we should try to live each moment as best we can. I'm not telling you anything new. So that the challenge for us, the spiritual challenge for us, is not to know these things, but the challenge for us is how do we activate them? How do we make it part of our lives? How do we embody those truths, those values that we already know? Yeah? And this is where the spiritual path comes in. Yeah? This is where we train ourselves doing meditation, train ourselves to be present, train ourselves to know and to understand what is happening moment to moment. Train ourselves to be more and more conscious. That's what meditation is. Meditation is expanding consciousness, becoming more aware, learning to know better. And when we learn to know better, we stay close to those things that are the most value to us. And we live in accordance with those things that are most meaningful and most beneficial. We don't close ourselves off from the highest part of ourselves. Often in these days, like in sort of popular psychology and things like that, they'll say, you know, be yourself, right? Which is fine, unless, you know, you're like, you know, if you suck, then why should you be yourself, right? Actually, the reality is that we're a mix of good and bad, right? I have good things in me, I have bad things in me, everyone's the same. And so be yourself is kind of a little bit missing the point, right? But the idea is be the best person that you can be. Right? I try to understand what are those values that are the most meaningful and most real to you, and aspire to those and live in accordance with those. And if we can do that, then we will live a life that every breath we're ready to die. Okay, so that's my talk for you this evening. And I hope I touched at least a few of the points that were raised. I think I got to a few of them. And I hope you provided at least a little bit of passing entertainment and solace for you in this long voyage that we share together. And I would like to invite, if there are any comments or questions, I believe we probably have a few questions from our international viewers. Very keen tonight. All right, okay, everyone's very keen about dying. All right. Okay, so let's do a few cues to A. Irish Jill from Greece. G'day, Irish Jill. How's it going in Greece? And so shout out to all of the Dharma practitioners in Greece. Okay, I no longer fear death. Okay? Maybe. Good, like if it's good. If you don't, then that's good. But sometimes, well, we don't really know, do we? But will I know when death is coming? No, you won't know when death is coming. That's an easy one. Sometimes people will know, like, you know, a short time before. When I was staying many years ago, I stayed in Ipoh in Malaysia, and there was there's a number of little cave temples around the place. And up the top of one of those cave temples, there was just like a little place to stay. And formerly, there'd been a Chinese monk staying there. And they said that the caretaker at that place had come up to see him one day, and he was an old monk, and he was dead, but he was sitting next to the bathing area, just sitting there naked in lotus position. And they just came up and they just found him there. Yeah? So he'd been having a bath and then just realized, this is it, it's coming, and then just sat meditation right away. And that's how he passed away. So you might know like shortly before, but you're not going to know long before. Okay, Ra Sunlight from South Perth. How's it going, Ra Sunlight in South Perth? Brainwaves can be detected several hours after death. Yes, this is true. Can be. And so maybe you can attend your own funeral. Right? I mean, this is the weird thing, isn't it, right? Because like when we have like loved ones and so on, and they're going to be passing away, and everyone's so sad. You're like, oh my goodness, it's so sad. I can't stand to see them pass. And then you're crying, oh, please don't leave us, please stay with us, and so on. But then once their body's gone, you really, really don't want them hanging around anymore, right? And once they've died, and if they come back and see us, maybe in a vision or a dream or a ghost or something like that, and you're like, ah, no, get away. So this is a kind of funny thing. So maybe you can attend your own funeral. I think certainly not beyond the realms of possibility that in some cases people might be aware in some kind of way of what's happening when they die. I'll just tell you one story about this. A number of years ago, many years ago now, maybe 2005, I was at a conference, Buddhist conference in KL, and there was a very moving words there spoken by this lady. She was very frail, and she got up onto the stage and spoke, and they'd been discussing the topic of euthanasia. And she spoke just of her own experience, and she had been extremely sick, and she'd been in a coma and unresponsive for a long time. But she was still aware, and she could hear everything. And she was sort of lying there in bed, and the doctor was talking to her sons and saying, look, there's no hope for her. We should turn off the machines and allow her to pass peacefully. And she's not lying there. Not dead yet. I'm not dead yet. And the sons were like, you know, so distressed with this, right? They couldn't make a decision. They said to the doctor, please let us wait till after the weekend. We'll tell you then what we're going to do. She's like lying there all weekend. I've got to wake up. And she did, you know, she showed some signs of life and movement, and eventually she recovered. So she was there. So that's not exactly what you're talking about, but it's not too far away. So I think that moment, I think one of the things is that the time of death is not like a specific thing. It's a process. And like all processes, it's complex, and it can happen in different ways for different people. It's not always going to be the same. So we shouldn't, you know, the attempt to sort of, you know, for medical purposes, we have to define death at a certain point. But that's really just a pragmatic rule of thumb, really, in terms of when does actually death occur, it's complex. Okay, Wolfram from Germany. How's it going, Wolfram, and everyone watching from Germany? How do you cope with the physical pain and fear when you're dying? Understanding the process will not help soothe the pain. What do we do? Okay, well, okay, so first of all, in terms of coping with the physical pain, then meditation is a good help there, because meditation just helps you to learn how to respond to the feelings in your body. You've all done this. You've all meditated. Anyone who's meditated, even for half an hour, already knows this, right? You feel discomfort and so on in your body, and you learn to watch those feelings and to just contemplate them with equanimity. And you learn that through meditating, and it's just natural. So that's something that will come to help you just naturally. Start now, right? Don't wait until it's too late. Many years ago, in the Buddhist society here, we heard a story from one of the Thai ladies who comes here, and she said that she had been involved in a car crash, and she was in the back seat. Car came into an intersection, another car came across from the intersection and smashed into her car. It was a terrible crash, and a number of people died in the two cars. And she was sitting in the back seat, and she said all she remembers is that when she saw the other car was coming and about to hit, her mind just immediately went to a meditation. And her mind just went inside, and she had no memory of the crash or the impact or anything like that. And she came back out of the meditation a few minutes after the crash, and she was completely unharmed. And, you know, people were dead and badly injured in the accident, and she, you know, whether that had anything to do with the meditation, I don't know. But that's how quickly it will come to you when you need it. Right? So when we say that these things will help, we're not just messing around. Right? These things can be a huge aid at that time if you practice it regularly. You don't have to be the most profound meditator. You don't have to practice for huge amounts of time every day, but just get into the habit of practicing regularly, and you'll find that these things will come to help you when you need them. So that's the number one thing. Then that sense of fear when dying, this is very deep and it's very profound, but it's different for different people. But the number one thing that you can do to overcome the fear of death is just that thing that I've talked about during the talk, is to live every moment to the fullest. You know, because that fear is about the unknown, it's about regrets, it's about confusion, right? And it's about your kind of projections about all of those things. But if you know that every minute of your life has been lived well, then you will always die well. As, you know, if you believe in karma and rebirth, then you believe that you've lived a good life and you'll go to good rebirth. If you don't believe in karma and rebirth, then you know that you've lived a good life, and that's the end of it, that's okay. But you still lived the best life that you can. Okay, understanding the process will not help soothe the pain. Not necessarily. I don't think that's entirely true. I think if we understand things, then we tend to be less afraid of them. And so this is why I think it's good to contemplate that process. It's not going to make it go away completely, of course, but it is going to help to reduce the anxiety and the stress around that pain, right? I mean, physical pain can be managed with medications and things like that to some degree, but the more important part is the existential pain, the fear and the anxiety, the sense of loss and confusion, right? So this is the main thing, to begin now, and if you begin now, you'll be okay. All right, so this is our questions that we had here. Is there any questions from the actual humans here? We've been talking to a machine for a little while. I know there's a human at the other end of it. Hello, human, yes. Okay. Into the microphone, please.
I've seen a ghost before.
Okay.
So, yeah, just wondering where that would fit into the scope of...
Do tell.
He was about 5 years old, 5 or 6 years old.
Okay.
It was early hours of the morning, and I was getting ready to go to work, and he was in between my children's bedrooms.
Okay.
My stepdaughter was living with us, and she would feel him for years before she came to live with us.
Okay.
He presented himself to me.
And what was the kind of feeling at the time? Like, was he...
His feeling or my...
Yeah, just the feeling of the event,
fear.
Yeah. Fear, yeah.
His feeling was sad. I could see it in his eyes. He was sad.
Okay.
He was reaching.
Yeah. Hmm, interesting. So, lots of people have these kinds of experiences. Yeah, a lot. And like, a lot of people say they believe in ghosts or they don't believe in ghosts and these kinds of things, but I think it's important to acknowledge that, it's not just a matter of superstitions or belief and things like that, but regardless of your belief, but a lot of people have these kinds of experiences. And it's very difficult to explain it. Like you said, it's not just you who had that experience, then it could be, you say it's a hallucination or whatever, but it's also shared with others. And so it's hard to explain. So, from a Buddhist point of view, how we would... What's going on? Okay. Without getting too much detail, but from a Buddhist point of view, of course, we believe that when this life ends, then that's not the end of the story, right? So our minds continue on, okay? Now, what continues on is not some kind of eternal spirit or soul or anything like that, okay? What continues on is just this same consciousness. Right? It's just a process. So it's just a conditioned process we experience now, and that conditioned process continues. So it's a bit like in physics, they have the idea of that energy can neither be created nor destroyed. So it's like a transformation of energy from one state to another. This is how we think about it. And so when that happens, I mentioned before, it's a complex process, right? And it, like any complex process, it doesn't always work 100%, right? One of the main metaphors that the Buddha used for talking about rebirth was moving house, right? It's very prominently used as a metaphor. In fact, one of the basic words for recollecting past lives in Buddhism is pubbe nivasa nusati, and the word nivasa means a house or a home. So it's like recollecting your former abodes, your former homes. So you can imagine that, if you take up that metaphor, then you think, well, when people move home, some people don't make it. Some people get stuck in between, right? Maybe you've sold your own home, the finance falls through, something like that, and you end up on the street. You end up homeless, right? And so the same kind of process can happen when people get reborn, that they can get stuck or they can get lost along the way. And so consciousness can kind of hang around for a while. And usually because of some attachment, because of some maybe confusion, because of something that's unfulfilled or that needs doing, something that's left undone. And then consciousness hangs around for a while, and that can then manifest in these various different kinds of ways. So that's kind of the normal way that we would understand that. So when something like that happens, the Buddhist response is to say, well, let's give them some love. Let's give them some care, right? So we don't sort of go in there and say, "Be gone, vile spawn of Satan, abomination," this kind of thing. But they're just lost. And so this is a very nice thing that, from a Buddhist point of view, because actually, like, we do exorcisms, believe it or not, not infrequently. And see, the thing is that maybe 9 times out of 10, it's actually just for the people in the home, right? Who are worried or lost and these kinds of things. It's not our job to really say, is this phenomena real or not real, right? But we go into the home and we'll do some chanting, we'll do some offerings, we'll do some blessings and do some loving kindness. And just for any of the beings who are around, you're loved, you're seen, we recognize you, we know who you are, you know, we wish you the best, and we wish that you find a true home and somewhere that you can live and be happy. And so when we do that, then whether or not there are any beings there, then at least it's good for the people in the home. So, yeah, so this is what we do.
So a couple of weeks later, I did release him and basically spoke those words. So
okay, nice. So he's happy now?
Courage, yeah.
Yeah. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. So, yes, that's DIY exorcism. Excellent. And so... If that works, then that's good. If it doesn't work, then you can call on the Ghostbusters down at Bodhinyana.
Good idea. Hi, my name is Alex.
Thank you for that.
And I'd like to make a comment
How are you going?
Yeah, not bad. I'd like to make a comment about what Buddha said about 2,600 years ago about thinking of the present moment.
Right.
And think about it as our last breath. But in today's society, it's a bit hard to do that because the world changed a lot. It's all this technology come up and everything is very hard. People don't think about it. When they go home, they probably think about their work, their family,
right?
Other things in life. Probably most of them, they think about how many likes they have on a Facebook.
Right.
So things change.
Right. Yeah.
So what can we do about
it? What can we do about it?
Not much.
when you die thinking, oh, if only I had more Twitter followers, I would have been happy, and I could die happy and fulfilled. Yeah, maybe you could like tweet your last moments.
Happiness yeah. become an illusion these days.
That's right. You're just like holding your phone there, and you just take one last selfie with your dying breath. All right, it'd probably be quite good, right? Yeah, you'd get lots of Insta followers that way. But like yes, it's true. We are distracted and all of those things. But you know, that was the case in the Buddha's time as well. Look, things haven't changed as much as we think they have, right? Now, when I was living in northeast Thailand, you know, I lived in some of the most remote villages in northeast Thailand, right? And these were places that were like one place I lived in. A monastery called Phujom Gom in the village was... what's the name of the village there again? I'm so embarrassed, I can't remember the name of the village now. And I do have... Oh, no, I don't know. Sorry. Okay, so... Tung Namuang is the name of the village. And... you know, the very, very, one of the last sort of really remote villages in Thailand, and even during the time that we were there, they had, I think, one telephone in the village, and they just were putting in a covered road to that place. And when we would talk to the villagers, you know, we'd ask them about their meditation. And, you know, how's your meditation going? You know, and these people lived a very simple lives and a very content lives, and... you know, by our standards, very, very, you know, nothing to complicate them. And they'd be like, Ajahn, it's so hard. I just keep thinking about my water buffalo. Like, oh, I know, right? Oh, I can't make my mind peaceful. I just, yeah. So it's pretty much the same. So wherever we are, and, you know, technology is okay. You know, we can use it for good things, you know. We can speak to the people around the world, and people can hear the Dhamma around the world, It's good. But we can take it too much and we can get distracted by it. I personally loathe social media. I think you should all delete your Facebook accounts and probably your Instagram accounts and Twitter accounts as well. And probably either, you know, spend a lot less time on your phones and things like that. But at the same time, I'm also a geek. I help develop a website, sort of central. And I'm not a programmer, but I work with programmers. And so, I sort of really love that technology, and I think it's very exciting and very fun and can be very useful. But you just have to try to use it properly. But humanity stays the same. I don't know. I mean, people talk about all these ideas like, oh, they're going to, you know, have AI and they're going to upload themselves to the internet and live forever and all of this kind of nonsense. But nah, it's not going to happen. We still don't know how to do stuff like center something in a web page, you know, and get it to display properly. You know, I mean, it's crazy to think that computers are going to become conscious anytime soon. Okay. So we should probably finish up. Let's pay respects to the Triple Gem.